In this hour of the show, we will be talking with Thomas Cahill. You perhaps might know him for one or more than one of his books, including How the Irish Saved Civilization, The Gifts of the Jews, and Desire of the Everlasting Hills. They've been bestsellers not only in this country, but also around the world. He has a new book in which he explores the legacy, both good and bad, of ancient Greece. And the title of the book is Sailing the Wine Dark Sea, Why the Greeks Matter. It's published by Doubleday. It's out now. If you're interested, you should certainly head on down to the bookstore and to take a look at it. Questions, of course, are welcome in this program. We just ask people to be brief who call in, and we ask that so that we can get in as many as possible and keep things moving. But, of course, anyone's welcome to join the conversation and take it in a particular direction if that is where your interest lies. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number to call, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line that is good to anywhere that you can hear us, around Illinois, Indiana, any place the signal will travel. Or if you're listening on the Internet, as long as you're in the United States, you may use that number as well. That's 800-222-9455. So here locally in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, and toll-free, 800-222-9455. Mr. Cahill, hello.
David.
Thank you for talking with us.
I'm very happy to be invited.
Well, we appreciate it. Exploring the Greeks and the culture of the Greeks, I guess, would seem to be a natural given the other kinds of cultures and influences on the culture of the West and the thinking of the West that you've done. But maybe just to start out, we can talk a little bit about how it is that this fits in with your larger kind of area of interest.
Well, what I began the series with was, at least in my own mind, the question, how did the West become the West? How did we become the people that we are? Why do we think the way we do and feel the way we do and perceive the way we do? Because we are in many ways, there are many ways in which Western thinking and feeling and perceptions are characteristic and not like other places and other traditions. And I decided to begin with How the Irish Saved Civilization because the story I had to tell there was the simplest story, and it occurs about halfway through Western history. It gave us a chance to look back to the classical period and forward to the medieval period. The book begins with the fall of the Roman Empire, and it ends with the beginning of the Middle Ages. And after that, I wanted to explore the making of the West in ancient times. So we went back to the very beginning, to the Jews. There is no West before the Jews. They really are the grandmothers and grandfathers of the West. And that was the gifts of the Jews. And then the subtitle was important, how a tribe of desert nomads changed the way everyone thinks and feels. And I think that's true. It's everyone, not just in the West, but it's had an effect. Certain cultural strains within Judaism have had an effect, finally, worldwide. Then we did the beginnings of Christianity, because early Christianity flows out of ancient Judaism. So that was the third book, Desire of the Everlasting Hills, The World Before and After Jesus. And those books needed to go together because they almost form a kind of diptych within the series. And now the fourth book, which brings us to the end of our study of the making of the West in ancient times, and that is the book on the Greeks, Sailing the Wine Dark Sea. I'm not going to do a book on the Romans. As I say in this book, the Romans keep taking bows throughout the series. They keep popping up. They're unavoidable, but the first two chapters, for instance, in How the Irish Saved Civilization really is about Rome rather than about the Irish. So they'll continue popping up, the next three books, the last three books in the series, which will bring us to seven books, the last three books will be about the making of the modern world, and they are yet to come, of course.
This book is organized in a series of chapters devoted to different archetypes and illustrating the fact that the Greeks had a great deal to do with the way we think about art and poetry and politics and warfare and indeed how we think about thinking. The title, as I'm sure a lot of people will recognize, comes from Homer, a man who created perhaps one of the greatest stories of war, among other things, that has ever been. And that's the place that you start. And certainly the Greeks did a great deal to shape how we think about how war should be fought, what constitutes heroism, what a warrior is supposed to be like, and we still today, the way we think about those very things, it goes back to ancient Greece. And now, of course, the downside perhaps is militarism in society. One might argue that has something to do with that too. But why start there? Why start with militarism, warfare, warrior culture in a book like this?
Well, the Iliad, which is the book that you were talking about, the great first epic poem of Homer's, is as far back as we can go, at least with writing. I mean, before that, there is, of course, archaeology and hints of what the Greeks were like before Homer. But Homer brings us to Greek history because he's the first person to write, there is no Greek writing to speak of before that. There are attempts at writing, but they're not very useful to us. They're really kind of inventories of what was in the armories and storerooms of the Greeks rather than stories that we can look at and understand, from those stories, understand what the Greeks were really like. The Iliad is really the great first masterpiece of Western literature. So it's unavoidable. Homer is the father of Greek literature. There is no literature before Homer, and of course Homer initiates this enormous stream of literature that just goes on century after century among the Greeks, who were extremely literary, extremely vocal. They were people who had for the ancient world an enormous vocabulary, and they could never stop talking. So we know a great deal about them because they left so many words behind them. So starting with the Iliad is necessary, and then it turns out that the Iliad is really a great hymn to war. And that's how it was viewed by many, many people. Alexander the Great, in a later period, always kept a copy of the Iliad under his pillow. It inspired Napoleon. It inspires me not to war, but to think about why it is that this is so important and has been so important throughout much of history. And in the Iliad, we see that in Homer's day, a kind of warfare was developing that has been essential to the domination by the West of large parts of the world. The Greeks invented rational warfare as opposed to mystical warfare. They didn't go out saying, "We're Greeks, we have these gods behind us, so we're going to win." They said, "Well, what kind of battle is this going to be? What's the size of the opposing force? What does the terrain look like? Can we win? Is it possible to win this battle? And if it isn't, maybe we shouldn't conduct it at all." What you have there are the beginnings of strategy, a good Greek word. And it's not just a word, but it's a concept that then goes through the rest of Western history. I mean, as recently as the first Gulf War, you have someone like Colin Powell enunciating the doctrine of overwhelming force. Well, that's nothing but a continuation of the Greek model of rational warfare. In other words, don't go to war unless you know beforehand that you can win.
Yeah. It's interesting that from them we do get those kinds of ideas, because they did believe in big decisive battles. They did also have this idea that in war there were rules. There were certain things that you should do and that you shouldn't. And I think also one of the things that we get from the Greeks is the idea of the citizen soldier.
Yes. in addition to the science of warfare, and they are the first people to come up with a science of warfare, you have behind that a kind of soldierly town meeting. On the night before the battle, everybody gets to put in his 2 cents and say, no, I don't think that's the way to do it. And the people who disagree with the generals are not immediately strung up and executed, as they might have been in other societies. They're listened to, because anybody's idea might be better than someone else's. And you see in the Iliad the beginnings, long before its formal adoption, you see the beginnings of Greek democracy by this freewheeling discussion. Before we actually go to battle, let's figure out what might happen and talk it through. It's so there, though we may have a kind of equivocal response to warfare, to the Greek warfare, we can't but be admiring of this open-air discussion that they have, which really which is extremely important to us, because we probably wouldn't have democracy without it.
The individual who, at least in this particular battle, was acknowledged to be not only the greatest warrior, but the bravest guy, the best looking guy. He was the star. He is the star. Although he definitely has his downside. You know the guy I'm talking about.
Achilles.
We're talking about Achilles, the man from whom, of course, we have the expression Achilles' heel. That weakness that everybody has. From the story, people remember the story that he was told that his parent was told that if you dip Achilles into the waters of the river Styx, he will be invulnerable. And so what they did was they held him just by his little baby heel and then dipped him in. So there was a little part of him that didn't get in the water.
Yeah,
so
it's a wonderful, as so many of the mythological stories of the Greeks, it's a wonderful story. It's been so useful throughout history. It gives us a way of discussing something very important in human affairs, that everyone has one of these. Mm-hmm. Achilles' heel.
So what do you find interesting about and significant about here in this whole discussion of warfare and how one conducts oneself and what it means to be a hero? What about Achilles is interesting?
Well, I point out that Achilles, at least to us at this point, I mean, we're far removed from the 8th century B.C. Achilles appears more a brat than he does a great hero. He's the kid who takes his marbles and leaves the playground because nobody will play the way he wants them to. He gets out of the war he's sitting in his tent cooling his heels and very, very angry for most of the epic. He's not, in my view, the real hero of the book. The real hero is the Trojan champion, Hector, who's a really good guy. You know, he's really someone you can admire in every way. He loves his wife and his kid, and he really is fighting only on their behalf, not because of the glory of warfare. Of course, he comes to a tragic end, and that ending, the death of Hector on the plain of Troy at the hands of Achilles, is really the great tragedy of the early classical period. It's the thing that everyone always referred to. It was the supreme tragedy that this good man should have been killed by this great soldier but flawed human being.
Let me introduce again our guest for this part of Focus 580, Thomas Cahill. He has a new book out that we're talking about. The title is Sailing the Wine Dark Sea, Why the Greeks Matter, and it's published by Doubleday. And as he explained at the beginning, he set out some time back to answer this question, how is it that the West, that is with the capital W, got to be the West? And he has now written a number of books looking at sources and influence. The books How the Irish Saved Civilization, which he says, in fact, really is about the Romans as much or more than it is about the Irish. The Gifts of the Jews, Desire of the Everlasting Hills, and this is now the fourth in this series, so the book about the ancient Greeks. The others are certainly out there in print in the library if you want to look at it. The new book is out in the bookstore. Questions are welcome, too. Here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. We do have a caller here to bring into the conversation, someone calling on a cell phone, so we will get right to them on line number one. Hello.
Yeah, just want to say I really enjoyed How the Irish Saved Civilization. And
thanks.
I haven't read the rest of your books, but I plan on doing so when I get some time. Anyway, I think the discussion of the Iliad and the Odyssey is in the Odyssey. I assume you were going to get to the Odyssey eventually, or perhaps is very important because I sense Homer actually criticizing an awful lot of the behavior that he's talking about.
I think you're right, and I think that was not understood by his own readers. I point out in the book that it really is not till the 18th century that the Odyssey, the second poem, begins to come into its own. In the ancient world, everyone assumed that the Iliad was the great poem, and as you go through Western history, and all history for that matter, the warrior with raised sword is really the archetypal hero of the human race. That's just the way it has been. But it's in the 18th century, or by the 18th century, some people are beginning to think that that's not always the case. And it's in the 18th, 19th, and 20th centuries that people begin to look at the Odyssey, which had earlier been thought to be the lesser poem, a poem of Homer's old age when he wasn't quite getting things right. And in this modern period, you begin to get critics saying, you know, actually, this is a more interesting poem. This is about a guy who's had enough of war, and all he wants to do is get home to his wife, child, and home. He's not interested in battle anymore. And it is, I think, a far more reflective poem. And interestingly enough, instead of being a tragedy, it's a comedy, a rather rough comedy. But he does get home at last. That's exactly what happens. And I think it is the deeper, older Homer reflecting on warfare and wondering whether it really is absolutely necessary, as most Greeks and most people in most ages have assumed.
Well, there's this scene in the Odyssey where Odysseus goes to, I may be misremembering this, but Odysseus gets to speak to Achilles when he's in the underworld, and Achilles is the king of the underworld. And Odysseus basically says something to the effect of, you know, well, how do you like it? And Achilles said, I'd rather be a slave. I'd rather be alive and a slave than be the king of the underworld.
Yeah, that's each of my chapters begins with one of the Greek myths, and the second chapter, the chapter about the Odyssey, actually begins with a long quotation from Odysseus in the underworld, and it's a wonder. Well, the speech that Achilles gives is so it really brings you up short.
Right. Well, I think it's a pity, in a way that. Well, I think we've sort of lost the baby with the bathwater. I understand, you know, in the Iliad and the Odyssey were often read in the past, and I think they sort of got rejected or lost somewhere along the way, or at least that's my impression. Perhaps I'm wrong, and they're not more widely read. But if they were, I think it would be very interesting to see if they were more widely read critically, because they, you know. Both of them challenge things about our culture and about a lot of, you know, they're just, well, what can
no,
I
No, they
say?
Do indeed. I agree with you. And as I point out in the book, to bring it into the present moment, there are any number of people advising in my view, rather unfortunate administration in Washington, that they should become more Greek, that they should be, in fact, you know, that they should become pagan, that we should throw away the Judeo-Christian ethic in favor of total warfare. And they're getting listened to by people like, I hesitate to even say his name, I'm not sure that, is this, can you say Dick Cheney on the airwaves, or do you get cut off?
No, it's okay, it's fine. He's the vice president, it's fine to mention his name.
Right. Well, to me, it's like a four-letter word. But in any case, people like him are really listening to these military gurus who are advising that we go back to the Greek way of warfare, full square, you know, four square, not pull our punches.
Well, I would point out that the Jews were not exactly.
Oh, we could go on about a whole bunch of earlier cultures.
We got this whole, you know, massacring entire populations thing. So
I'm not trying to denigrate the Greeks. I love them in many ways, but I do think that we have to stop and ask ourselves where some of these ideas came from and whether or not they are actually still useful to us.
Well, thanks for the call.
Mm-hmm.
I appreciate it. Just to stay with Odysseus for a moment, because I don't know if all cultures have wanderer stories, but I expect probably a lot of them do. And for the West, for European culture, probably this is our archetypal wanderer story.
Yeah, it is. Though there were earlier ones. I mean, you know, you could find them in Sumer, for instance, in Mesopotamia.
Gilgamesh.
Yeah, I mean, that's a wanderer story to a large extent.
But certainly it is the case that Ulysses, Odysseus, is probably one of the best known figures in Western literature.
Yep.
And he is our wanderer. So in having that be one of our basic stories, how does that influence the way we think about home and what that is, about travel and what that is, about loneliness and what that is?
I think so, but I for sure. But I also think that most important of all is that Odysseus is not the great warrior. He is a man who lives by his wits. He survives and finally triumphs, not by the sword, but by his mind. And I do think that that was Homer's point. That is a greater accomplishment than winning a battle. Rather, Odysseus wins all these battles of wits with various monsters and supernatural creatures, and he does it by being smarter than they are, and thus he finally does get home, which I think for Homer at the end of his life is the object that we should all seek, domestic peace, to be happy at home rather than to be out with a sword.
Let's talk with someone else. We have a caller, I believe, in Charleston. That would be line four. Hello?
Yes. The stories are full of heroics and heroic death and all the things that surrounded these aggressions, both ancient and modern. It occurs to me, and maybe hopefully your guest can answer the question, somebody had to do the dying, and whoever did the least dying seemed to always win. But there was these armies. These leaders didn't go out and confront each other like gladiators in Roman times, but there was a standing army, and those people did the dying, and mainly in ancient times, I think those folk lived from plunder. But nevertheless, maybe your guest can articulate who was it then that did the dying. I'll ring off and listen. Thanks.
All right.
Well, actually, the way Homer presents it, the generals did plenty of dying. By the end of the war, very few of them are alive. Very few of them are still standing. And Odysseus is one of those who actually does get out of there and makes it home. And even some of the ones who make it home face terrible consequences, like Agamemnon, who's killed by his wife and her lover when he finally gets back to Mycenae. But there's also great truth in the fact that though many of the generals died, many of the leaders died, of course, the by far the hugest part of the dying was simply among the troops. And even though Homer does not underline that, if you read carefully, you can find that in the text.
From the Greeks, we get a lot of our ideas about what constitutes good government, how government should be structured, what are the duties and the rights and responsibilities of the citizen, who gets to be a citizen. And again, here we have something of the of the plus and the minus, with ideas about citizen participation in government, but then limited ideas about who is a citizen, men are, women aren't. As frequently, I'm sure, whenever we have a conversation like this, someone will want to mention the fact that the Greeks condoned and practiced slavery. So here there are some up and down, but I guess we do have to acknowledge that an awful lot of our ideas about these very things do indeed come from the Greeks.
Yes, the there's no way around it, and we shouldn't try to find a way around it, that the participation in democracy in ancient Athens was pretty limited. This was a warrior society in which the warrior was central, and therefore they thought simply of men who were the warriors as being the guys who should take charge and tell everybody else what to do. Women were really banished from the public square. They had no public role at all. They were supposed to stay at home and make babies, and that was really their usefulness in the society. That's how it's always described in all the literature. And Athens, beyond the situation of women, Athens was a slave society. It was economically based on slavery, as very few societies in history have been. We can only count up a few, ours being the early democratic America being one of those. We think of it as slavery as having been universal, but it was not. I mean, there was a lot of what was called slavery, but it would have been much more like medieval serfdom, in which the supposed slave actually had rights, but he did not in ancient Greece, and he or she did not in ancient Greece. And because it was such a warrior society, to a large extent, it was about domination, and who got to dominate and who got to be dominated. And whether we're talking about warfare or sex, the large question was, who's on top? And that's how the Greeks viewed things. And yet, out of that extremely stratified, and by to our way of looking at things, rather depressing society, there came for the first time the idea of democracy at all, in which you had constant town meetings. In fact, the Athenians really went overboard. They not only invented democracy, but their democracy was a direct democracy, sort of like California gone mad. Everybody got to vote on it. Everyone who was a citizen got to vote on everything. They even voted on who would be general for the coming year. It's amazing that they voted on. They had what I think of is one of their most wonderful inventions, which was ostracism. Once a year, they could put on an ostraca, which was a piece of pottery, the name of the person that they most thought the city could do without in the next 10 years. And that would always be someone who was somehow, by his power, was a danger to the democracy. And if a majority of citizens voted for this person, he was exiled for 10 years. He didn't lose his property or anything, but he had to leave the city in order to defer the danger that he was perceived to be to their democracy. I think we could probably profit from that. Or, if not actually, we should certainly think about it.
We are a bit past our midpoint here, and we have another caller, and also would like to introduce again our guest. We're talking with Thomas Cahill. He is the author of a number of books that examine the cultural heritage, sources of culture of the West, and they are How the Irish Saved Civilization, The Gifts of the Jews, and Desire of the Everlasting Hills. And they've sold very well. A lot of people have read and enjoyed them. His newest in this series deals with ancient Greece, and it's titled Sailing the Wine Dark Sea, Why the Greeks Matter. It's published by Doubleday. Questions are certainly welcome. 333-9455. Toll free, 800-222-9455. We have another caller here in Urbana, line number one. Hello.
Hello. I would have a suggestion if you do get around to writing another book. It seems to me, rather than the Romans, It's the Persians, the Iranian Mede Persians, who deserve a treatment, because they were really the schoolmasters for the Greeks.
Yeah, well,
and they're much neglected.
Yeah, I wouldn't agree that they were the schoolmasters.
Well, the Greeks wrote history, but
and I've
gotten a much better press, but they certainly were the civilizing influence there.
I would actually disagree with that. I think that the Egyptians were far more important to the Greeks than the Persians. The Persians were always seen as a menace, and therefore the Greeks didn't learn as much from them as they might otherwise have done. But I will not be doing a book on the Persians, because I'm sticking to the Western world, and the Persian world is really only tangentially part of that.
Oh my, that's not true.
They
were a powerful influence upon
true,
the Judeo-Christian religion. They invented monotheism.
And
who rebuilt the temple?
The Jews invented monotheism.
No, they didn't.
Persian
Zoroaster had
later.
Come up with it before.
No, it's not true. That's not true.
No, it is too. The
1900 BC.
The Jews had a single god for their people, the god of the Jews. But Zoroaster first taught monotheism as the only god.
No, I'm sorry, but you just have it wrong. You're missing.
No, I haven't. You better go back and read the history.
We can't, I think we have a fundamental disagreement, which we cannot sort out on this program. I don't know. Mr. Cahill?
Well, anyway.
Well, I deal with monotheism and how it developed in the gifts of the Jews, and it's a very considered discussion, and it would take much longer. It takes a book. So it takes much longer than a program to actually discuss.
Yes, I think you're right, and I think it deserves a great deal of attention. There's a tremendous influence there. The Judeo-Christian angels, for instance, seem to be modeled upon the Iranian fairies.
Yeah, I don't think so. I actually think that both the Judeo-Christian angels and Iranian version goes back to something much earlier, which probably was extant in Mesopotamia, and we have certain surviving pictures or art that would lead us to believe that. So,
well, I'm not going to take up more of your time, because you're so much more interesting than I would be, and I think you did a great contribution in examining the Irish in particular, because they too have been neglected and I think unappreciated. Thank you.
Thank
All right.
you.
Well, thanks for the call. Let's go on. The next caller in line is in Champaign, and line two. Hello.
Hi there.
Yes.
I just had one quick question. I wondered if you could tell me what's the cheapest, easiest way to get the entire set. Is there a book set ordered, offered, or is it in paperback?
I don't believe there is. I've encouraged the publisher to do that, but they just sell them individually, but you can get them easily from any bookshop. If they're not all in stock at a given moment,
mm-hmm.
Any bookshop is quite happy to take an order.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right, thanks. I expect that probably the earlier books are all in paper now.
Yes, they are. Not the current one.
Not the current one. But
hardcover, but the earlier ones are available in both hardcover and paper.
We have talked about the fact that the way that you approach the book is in setting out certain kinds of archetypal figures that have done a lot to shape the way we think about a number of important things. And I guess probably the most basic thing of all is the Greek contribution to the way we think about thinking and how it is we do that. And here, again, probably the figure that I'm not sure how much people really know about Socrates, other than the fact that, he got in trouble with the authorities and he was compelled to commit suicide. He was sentenced to death because he was just too much trouble. He sounds like he was quite the character.
Well, there's no question that he was a great pain in the neck.
Yeah, exactly. That's a good way to put it.
I mean, you have to. He wasn't put to death idly or trivially. He had really annoyed so many people, I tried to present him that way in the book, so that you're not in the dark about what kind of character he was and how many people he rubbed the wrong way. And he had this great thing, which of course we still call to this day the Socratic method. he claimed to know nothing, and he would just ask other people who claimed to know something a series of questions, gradually exposing their ignorance and holding them up to ridicule. Well, young people in Athens got a great kick out of this and would follow him around and howl and hoot when he exposed the ignorance of various pompous figures of Athens, who I think finally just ganged up on Socrates. It's a little hard because, you know, Socrates didn't actually write anything, and everything, almost everything we know about him comes through his pupil Plato, who makes Socrates the hero of all of his dialogues, his philosophical dialogues, and there are 25 of those. They begin with, you know, various kinds of conversations about some subject or another, but sooner or later Socrates shows up and, by asking a series of radical questions, sets everything to rights. Out of that, of course, came the philosophical discourses of Plato. The later ones, even though Socrates shows up in them, we're pretty sure couldn't really have been Socrates' own ideas. Plato's just using him. Plato goes on then to elaborate a much more far-reaching philosophy than Socrates ever did. And Plato is the great philosopher of the Western world. As others have said, all philosophy is but a footnote to Plato. Plato really is the one who enunciates a very deep value of the Greeks, which is that though we are practical people and we look at things realistically, we have this yearning for an ideal, for something better than what we have, for another world altogether. And that, of course, becomes Plato's world of the forms, but there is this deep yearning within all of Greek literature for something better, something more ideal. And then, of course, it really breaks out in the art of the 5th and 4th centuries, where these ideal figures, these beautiful ideal figures, come to be from the hands of the sculptors. And we see almost vividly and concretely the yearnings of the Greeks expressed in these statues.
We have a number of other callers. Let's talk with some more folks here in Urbana, line number one. Yes, hello.
Hi. I'm wondering if you could say anything about Thomas Mann's books about Joseph in Egypt. This is kind of an attenuation on that other caller. I turned in late.
You know, I really can't. I have to admit, no one has read everything, and though I've read some of Thomas Mann, I have not read that material, so I really don't have a comment. I humbly admit.
Thanks.
All right. Well, we'll just go on to another person here, line two. This is also Urbana. Hello.
Yes. Good morning, Thomas. With a limited amount of time, I hesitate to raise the specter of Julian James and the breakdown of the bicameral mind.
Oh, go ahead, raise it.
But this is sort of an ongoing debate some of us are having here.
Why don't you make sure that the listeners know what you're talking about.
All right. James's theory is that really the first conscious Greek was Homer himself, and most of the criticism was that about the warriors. The warriors were all led around by the voices of the gods, and there was a kind of psychosis present in the ancient world. And with the matriarchy was overthrown by the Peloponnesian tribes that came down from Macedonia, we finally were able to develop something of a priest class, and I'm just wondering how you kind of in your own work how you sort of put the rise of the patriarchy over the previous matriarchal forms, the rise of the priest class and the warrior class, how that all
okay.
And slavery, how that all kind of dovetails together, and that's enough for you to handle. I'll let you go.
Yeah, I think there are three questions there at least.
The
first, with regard to the first one, the theories of James about the bicameral mind, and that, you know, that early people had a divided mind and didn't realize it, and that they had these experiences of gods talking to them, not just in Greece, but he goes back, for instance, to Abraham, who, as I said earlier, is about 2000, almost 2000 BC, and that he was, you know, that God talking to him was an instance of what he would call primitive schizophrenia, and that that's the way the human mind was organized at that time, and then that it evolved to what we have today, which is no longer schizophrenic, at least not in most people. I think that top to bottom, the theory is absolute and utter nonsense. So I have not dealt with it directly in any of the books that I've written so far, and probably will not. I don't think there's any evidence for it except in James's own mind. And I think that it's there for him because he thinks that if anyone hears a voice, he must be a schizophrenic. Therefore, Abraham was a schizophrenic. Therefore, all the characters in Homer who speak to gods or who hear gods are schizophrenics. Well, that is, the theory is not based on evidence, but on radical atheism, that there's nothing out there to listen to, and therefore anyone who hears anything must be nuts. Or historically schizophrenic prior to our evolutionary track that brought us to the present mind that most of us have, but then, of course, anybody who actually believes in God or believes that God could speak to them would be a throwback, a kind of Neanderthal. I just don't think any of that is true. With regard to patriarchy and matriarchy, there's been a lot of work done on this and a lot of talk that goes beyond the evidence. There is no hard evidence anywhere, despite the books written by Gimbutas, who's usually the person most cited, that there were true matriarchies in the prehistoric world. Of course, prehistoric world is very hard to work with because it's prehistoric. We don't have written evidence. We just have statues and various kinds of art. And the problem with art is that it's subject to interpretation in a way that words are not. Of course, words are subject to interpretation too, but not in the way that art is. And therefore, you can come up with all sorts of theories about art, especially when there is no written evidence to go along with it. And you can come up with all sorts of things. I think that there were certainly matrilinear societies. I think it's yet to be proved that there was anywhere in human prehistory an actual matriarchy. There were certainly societies that tended toward that worshipped the mother goddess rather than the sky god. But I don't see that they were matriarchal. And nor does the best opinion among archaeologists.
All right. We have one more caller, at least, Champaign County, line number 3. Hello.
Hi. I have a problem with the whole concept of the Occident, actually, the West. And I think you implied that you only study the West. I think particularly when you go back to Greek times, you have to admit that the West was pretty East. Something that sort of iconically grabs that for me is the whole idea of the classical period, these statues you referred to a couple of times, the art interpretation. The marble, white marble statues that we sort of keep in our museums and have frescoes of here at the U of I, that they were actually painted quite brilliantly, frescoed. And it's for that to me sort of is an icon for the misapprehension. You talked about the misapprehension of Homer's writing through the decades, but I think the Anglo-Saxon world, I think, has a deep-seated misapprehension of the life of the Greeks.
Yeah, well, I make quite a bit out of the fact that that Greek art and architecture was extremely colorful, as are the metaphors of Homer. They're much more like the wine dark sea and the rosy fingered dawn than they are, as they now seem, you know, tasteful white marble statues. That's not what they were at all. That is a misapprehension when people assume that that's what Greece was. Classical Greece was in many ways not terribly classical at all. With regard to the West, these are words. We normally speak of the Western world. The Western world, of course, did begin in the East. It begins with the Jews. It begins in Mesopotamia. It begins in Asia. Though the Greeks were not Asians, they had a tremendous amount of contacts with the East, and especially with North Africa. Greek art and architecture originating moment is Greeks going to Egypt and seeing for the first time the temples and the statues, and coming back and changing those things, making them into a much more characteristically Greek kind of art and architecture. But their original inspiration was Egypt. So I have no problem with that, and I'm not trying to create a kind of wall between the Orient and the Occident or anything remotely like that. But simply the question I'm asking is, how did we become the people that we are? And I go back as far as I can into the sources. And when you can't go any further, you have to stop, even though you know that there are trails that are now erased.
Well, we normally speak this way, but it just as classical evokes this whole image of pristine white marble, the way of speaking about it actually sort of limits our understanding, it seems.
Well, I think if you read my books, you will find that that is not so, that I don't just assume certain things on the basis of words that we throw around, but try to find out where these things actually came from. My books are about going back as far as we can into the sources and finding the original font, so to speak, of each of the characteristics that we are aware of, that we possess today.
We're going to have to stop. I'm sorry to say, my apologies to the caller, but we simply exhausted our time. For folks who are interested in exploring this subject further, of course, you can look for the book that we've talked about, Sailing the Wide Dark Sea, Why the Greeks Matter, published by Doubleday, by our guest Thomas Cahill. And you might also look for his other books, How the Irish Saved Civilization, Gifts of the Jews, and Desire of the Everlasting Hills. And Mr. Cahill, thank you very much for talking with us.
David, thank you.
Great pleasure.